If you only listen to our podcasts, I want to encourage you to visit unfetteredmind.org. Here you'll find, free of charge, dozens of original articles and contemporary translations of Buddhist texts and prayers. If you find these helpful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate so we can continue to expand the website and support your practice. Thanks.
Unfettered Mind, the nuts and bolts of dreams.
So let's begin with the guided meditation while we're still fresh and awake. So just take a few minutes and let mind and body settle. Sorry about that, I moved it. Now, I mentioned earlier, I read a section from Uchiyama in which he said that when we are born, the world we experience is born with us. We live in this world, and when we die, the world we live in dies with us. So in this meditation, when we talk about things dissolving, it's not only you and your body dissolving, but also everything in your experience dissolving. So let mind and body settle. Rest with the coming and going of the breath. And imagine that you are dying and that you know you are dying. And the first part of this, as is traditionally described, is that the earth element dissolves. Earth refers to the quality of solidity in our experience. Solidity, structure, and order. As the earth element dissolves, the experience of earth momentarily intensifies. Your body feels completely rigid. You are unable to move. Things in your experience seem completely fixed. You have the experience of a weight, a tremendous weight crushing your body. Like you're wedged between this weight and whatever you're lying or resting on. And as those sensations dissipate, consciousness, how you experience things, becomes unsteady. And there may be a certain amount of fear or confusion associated with that. So just breathe and experience all of that for a few moments. And then the water element dissolves. You lose the ability to retain or control the fluids in your body. Spittle dribbles from your mouth, so forth. Subjectively, it feels like you are in a flood or being carried away by a wave or a current. And again, there's fear associated with that. And the sense of flow and experience dissipates. And the clarity of consciousness fades, and everything becomes hazy and smoky. And then the fire element dissolves. Physically, you feel the warmth receding from your limbs, your hands and feet, and then your arms and legs start to grow cold. Subjectively, you feel like you have an intense fever, that you're burning up. You may feel extremely thirsty. And consciousness loses its brilliance and becomes momentary and intermittent, like sparks, or like the flashing of fireflies. And then the air element begins to dissolve. Your breathing becomes increasingly difficult. It rasps as it goes in and rattles as it goes out. Each breath is a struggle, and you may feel like you're suffocating. And there's all the panic and desperation that comes with that. Bursts of energy, like gusts of wind, race around in your body. And you find yourself lost in all of the commotion, the swirling around, as you are carried away and whirled away by a powerful wind. Your consciousness or consciousness and experience lose their dynamism, and all that remains is a vague impression of the world, like a faintly glowing ember that's just about to go out. You're barely aware of those around you and of your surroundings. your sense faculties disintegrate. Sight, hearing, taste, touch, and smell cease to function in any way. You feel very alone, isolated, off balance, cut off from everything. A rapid series of hallucinations arises. Things appear like a mirage, hazy, weak flashes of light, dim glows. It's all very confusing. And then everything dissolves into light. It's a soft, gentle, white light. No center or periphery. There is no sense of other anymore. And there's no aversion. So there's a sense of peace. And you feel movement of energy upward somehow. And the sensation of light intensifies. And there is just light. The sense of I as something separate and distinct disintegrates. And with it all sense of attraction. At this point, things are very clear. And now you find yourself plunging into an infinite blackness. Nothing by which you can orient yourself. It's as if the very basis of consciousness is dissolving. And now there is an experience of an infinite field of light, as if you're at the center of the sun. And there you rest. When you're ready, come back into this room and open your eyes. But come back with the sense that the light comes with you. This, according to the Tibetan tradition, is what happens when we die. the earlier stages of this are reasonably well corroborated by people who work with dying people. The loss of movement in the body, the loss of control of fluids, the receding of warmth, so forth. The subjective experiences arise not necessarily in everybody, but frequently enough. In case of sudden death, like heart attack, or being shot or killed in an accident, these stages go by more quickly than can be recognized. The final stages, these sequence of lights, again, these are corroborated in a number of cases by people who have near-death experiences. They report things like light and so forth. One's ability to actually experience those things depends on, to a great extent, the stability of one's attention. It's very helpful in practice to familiarize yourself with this process and do this as a meditation. Not just as a preparation for dying, because we actually don't know how we're going to die. But because the same process takes place whenever we transition from one experience to another. Usually it's so quick and fleeting that we don't notice it. And many people have found when they do this practice, it's actually a way of moving into the experience of mind itself. Now we have to be very careful here. It is human nature to transform experience into some kind of objective reality. These are subjective experiences. And we may use terms such as mind itself or Buddha nature or pristine awareness. But we're not referring to anything with those words. Those words refer to a way of experiencing. Not to something that exists. And there's a lot of confusion about that. Going back to Uchiyama, what we're experiencing is the dissolution of ourselves and the world we experience. We actually experience that dissolution when we go to sleep at night. We experience it at the end of every dream. And this is one of the reasons that dream practice and sleep practice were cultivated in the Tibetan tradition to get really used to these transitions. They're fairly demanding, subtle practices. And the question is why? The reason to become familiar with these transitions is so that we can make them without holding on to trying to keep things the way we want them to be. In other words, these are ways of learning to die. And as I said at the beginning of this retreat, I think one of the most important things we can learn in our lives is how to die. Because as we've been discussing, circumstances change and something new emerges, yet we usually try to hold on to the old, keep it in place, and don't let it or our relationship with it or our identity that's associated with it, any of that stuff die. And it creates suffering for ourselves and for others. It's very frightening for many. To approach life with there being absolutely no ground to anything. A constant process of change in which you can count on nothing. Yet that's exactly how the world and how experience is described in Buddhism.
Question was submitted by Alanda from Louisiana. I read a book on dream yoga by a teacher in the Bon tradition. It stated that women should lie on their left side while sleeping and men on their right, as the Buddha did when he was dying. Why would that be? Do you agree with this instruction? Should one also do this at the time of dying? Also, when one is dying, do the Buddhist teachings say something about the red drops being more prominent in females and white drops in males during the dissolution process?
Well, I imagine you're referring to Tenzin Wangyal's book on dream yoga and clear light. The suggestion that women sleep on their left side, men sleep on their right, has to do with the way that energy channels are configured differently in men and women. The channel through which reactive processes or reactive energy flows is on the right side in men and on the left side in women. And so when men sleep on the right side and women sleep on their left side, they're actually reducing the flow of energy through the reactive channel and opening up the wisdom channel on the opposite side. Now, realistically, these are pretty subtle levels of energy, and there are many, many considerations. So many other factors have to come into consideration. So there are many people who lie on the opposite side and it doesn't make any appreciable difference to their practice. One's working with refined states of energy when you're doing this, and if you're able to work at those levels of subtlety and you find it makes a difference, then it's appropriate to follow these instructions. And yes, these are connected with the time of dying as well. The same kind of instruction is given for the same reason.
in the Great Path of Awakening, which is a commentary on mind training in 7 points. If one can, one, it's suggested one die sitting upright, as many, many people have done. If you're not able to do that, then men lie on the right side, women on the left, for exactly the same reasons. As for the second part of your question, this refers to something I'm not familiar with. I know in Buddhism, in Buddhist practice, everybody has the two drops, the red drop at the red drop of vitality, which is usually regarded as being stored at the navel center, and the white drop of vitality at the head center, and basically where the pituitary gland is, and that at the time of death, these two drops move toward the heart, and when they move toward the heart and join there, then one dies. I'm not familiar with this business about it being one being more prominent in females and the other being more prominent in males. So I don't think I can answer that part of your question. Thank you.
This is from Maya in Goleta, California. Regarding lucid dreaming, I'm not very familiar with the Tibetan approach other than these two ideas, that one should treat all experience as a dream and that waking up is the point 24 hours a day. And I know that the Western approach involves trying to steer the dreams towards specific experiences. This has always struck me as not that different from the way we try to control our waking lives. So I'm wondering, in daily meditation practice, we're usually training in various forms of letting things be as they are. We're giving up control. Therefore, in the Tibetan Buddhist system, do the approaches to waking experience and to lucid dreaming have the same intention?
I'd like to clarify a few things first. The term lucid dreaming in the Tibetan tradition refers to practices through which one comes to know that you're dreaming when you are dreaming. In other words, you wake up in the dream. The dream continues, but now you know it's a dream. And the practice is taken further than that. Then you're able to gain a certain mastery of the dream state and being able to do things intentionally. So it's a form of getting a sense of what, or the intention of the practice is you get a sense of what it means to be awake, because now you can look at everything in the dream and know that it's just your own mind. And it's also a way of training intention. This is not exactly the same as control. One isn't necessarily trying to have specific experiences, but to train this quality of wakefulness and to train the ability to intend. Both of these are very important skills, if you wish, which are applied in our daily life. One recalls the dream experience and you look at the world you experience now and say, everything's this, just like a dream. That is, everything that I'm experiencing is my mind. And this, in our daily life, this is very radical because we're so conditioned to regarding things as other. And when, just as when you're looking at things in a dream, you are looking at your mind. So when we look at things in our daily life, we are also looking at our mind. We don't usually approach things this way. And when we start living that way, things become very, very different. For the first thing is that any sense of opposition becomes completely meaningless, because we would be opposing our own mind. that makes a huge difference in how we relate to difficulties and adversity in our life. The whole practice of intending becomes very important, because we discover that by forming an intention, then things, we create the conditions in which things manifest. And because the daily life experience, things are much more solidified than they are in a dream, the intention doesn't manifest as quickly as it can in a dream. But we find that when we intend something and are able to hold that intention, then other possibilities open to us, and we can bring things about that we wouldn't have been able to before, internally and externally. So that's my understanding of how these dream practices apply.
This is from Maya in Goleta, California. Often spiritual teachers claim they don't dream anymore because they don't need to. They seem to be implying that the impetus for all dreams is reactive patterns, and that one should get over any interest in dream content. Do you agree? But what about big dreams, in which insights and experiences of opening occur and affect waking life and practice in seemingly positive ways?
Well, none of my teachers claimed they didn't dream anymore, though I have read that at certain advanced stages of practice, then dreams naturally subside. I haven't ever heard of people saying that they can intentionally stop dreaming. That seems to me to be rather like saying, a person saying they can stop thinking. That being said, most of the dreams that we have are just like our thoughts, just stuff processing itself in our system. Conctrell the Great advises people that when they wake up in the morning is not to spend any time analyzing or thinking about their dreams, but to move right into being awake and present in what you're experiencing right now. As you say, there are some dreams which seem to have special significance or can help lead us to, or through which we come to know or understand something that we didn't before. That's that aspect of waking up, showing up in our experience, and it happens to show up in our dreams rather than in our waking life. But it doesn't make it, if we're able to utilize it, then it's quite useful. I mean, we used to practice a meditation in the 3-year retreat, which was a dream experience by one of the teachers of our tradition. So he felt it was important enough that he actually made a meditation practice out of it. So the difficulty here is that while dreams may be pointers, it's difficult to tell whether they're pointing at something that has happened, something that is happening, or something that's going to happen. And for this reason, one isn't encouraged to spend a lot of time analyzing it. Usually, if a dream is vivid and clear and has obvious meaning, it's pretty obvious what that meaning is. But in the Jungian and Freudian sense, dream analysis is not particularly valued, in at least in my own form of training in Buddhism.
Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you wish to use part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.